Thank you to all of you for coming out tonight. As I was, I left Santa Fe, I took a road trip to get here, so I left last Thursday with my dog, and we've been driving through the high desert, and it's been an extraordinarily dry winter in Santa Fe, which usually gets snow this time of year. We've had nothing. So to come down to the lowlands and to be in moisture, as I was sitting zazen, I was just feeling like, oh, soggy zazen, this is so good. It's very, very different quality than the crisp, high desert, dry zazen. So thank you again for coming out tonight. Gotta get myself set up here. And I have to say, after driving, I don't know if any of you have done that drive, like from Santa Fe on Interstate 40 through Flagstaff, and there are some really depressed towns on that path. I stopped, to get gas and to stretch my legs with my dog in places like Winslow and Needles. And they're just kind of like ghost towns in a way. So to come here and to just, be embraced in a beautiful Zen center like this and just feel a space of practice and community and connection, it's such a gift, such a rare gift these days in a lot of places. So really appreciating that. So as Kokia said, I've got this book that's out, and I just appreciate the invitation to come and share a little bit about the book. And so I'm going to offer you a Dharma talk that I'm calling The Dharma of Right Livelihood. So it's kind of explores the main theme that the book is about. And then afterwards, I did bring a box of them. So if anybody would like to get one, I have them for sale. We'll set them up out on the soggy table outside. And I'm happy to sign them for you. Some of you might already have copies. So it's sort of a book signing as well. Oh, your water tastes really good. This is the book, by the way. It still feels a little surreal. It just came out like less than a month ago, and it took a good couple of years to write it, so it feels a little surreal to like look at it, like, oh, yeah, I did that. And I also really want to call into the Zendo tonight, and I know many of you know them, but Chuck and Nanette, long time. I bet you guys miss them. And we're really lucky to have them living in Santa Fe and practicing at Upaya. So Nanette especially was the one who kind of encouraged me to connect here and helped to make this evening happen. So grateful for that friendship, that Dharma friendship. So this thing called work, we spend a great deal of our life energy on it. If you've got a job where you work 40 hours a week, you're spending more than half your waking hours at this activity. And I know many of you probably do much more than that. So work can be a source of profound meaning for us, but it also can be a source of stress and suffering, which I'm sure a lot of folks have experienced. According to a recent survey that the Harvard School of Public Health did, nearly half of working adults say that their current job affects their physical health, but only 28% of them feel like that is a positive effect. So, like, nearly three-quarters of people feel like there's some negative physical effect that's going on from their work. And that number gets much higher, the percentage of people who feel like there's dissatisfaction and stress involved with their jobs. For people who have disabilities, and people in dangerous or low-paying jobs. So, it's both potentially a source of profound joy, but the unfortunate reality is for a lot of folks, it's a source of profound suffering. And for our practice, as you know if you spend any time in a Zen center, it's actually just as much of a practice as sitting meditation, as Zazen is. So Samu in Zen traditions is especially has a central role in helping us to wake up off the cushion. And Chinese Zen master Bai Zhang as some of you might know, he once said, a day without work is a day without food. And I think that he meant that in the sense of, like, it's literally as nourishing for us as food if we're doing it in a way that's based in practice. So based on, in my own life, the reason why this book came through and the reason why I often think that one of the driving questions in my life is, has been, how can I find work that I love? And for me, I remember that coming from way back when I was a little kid. And I grew up in Southern California. And my dad worked at the automobile club, the AAA. So he was the guy that you would go to if you wanted to, like, do cross-country trips. And he would do your triptych. And he knew about, like, all the fun places to go, you know, the back roads to travel. So he loved travel. And so it seemed like that should have been a great job for him. But he was just miserable. And I remember this so clearly when I was growing up. I remember I was an only child, so it was, you know, my mom and I, we would be at home. My mom would have made dinner, and my dad would be late almost every night from work. So we'd be sitting there, the food would get cold. He would come home, and then he would sit at the dinner table and just kind of exude despair. And it turned out, I mean, he, you know, the job itself, there are things about that he really loved, and he loved to travel. But I think what he was doing was vicariously helping other people to do what he loved, and he never really got a chance to do that himself. And his, you know, he was constantly given more than he could do in a day, so that's why he was always late, working overtime, not really getting paid for it. He had a boss that he didn't really get along with so well. And like almost everybody, you know, he lived for his 2 weeks or 3 weeks of vacation every year. And the rest of the time he was pretty miserable. And I would sit there at the dinner table, and I would just think to myself, there's got to be a different way of doing this. Like, I don't want to live my life like that. And then as I grew up, and my very first job was an esteemed job at the Kentucky Fried Chicken counter, where I lasted for all of about 2 weeks in a summer job. You know, so then I got to experience that, too, that kind of like, oh, my God, this is horrible, and, you know, seeing friends and their families, their parents kind of go through the same thing. Like almost everybody, for almost everybody, work was something to be tolerated at the very best. And you just kind of hung in there until you got to the weekend or you got your couple of weeks of vacation every year. So that planted this seed for me of like, I'm not going to do that. And I did everything I possibly could to, I was like on a quest to try to find work that I loved. And so that work odyssey took me through, I really have honestly lost count, but at least 5 different careers and countless jobs within those careers. So I've started out, I got a degree in music therapy, that was my bachelor's degree. I worked for 10 years as a mental health professional, got terribly burned out doing that. That's sort of a whole nother Dharma talk, but not because of the people I work with, but just because of the system, the very dysfunctional system that I worked within. For any of you that work in healthcare or education, you probably know that those systems are actually not doing what they're designed to do, right? Well, they are doing what they're, but they're not educating. They're about conformity, and healthcare is about profit, right? So I was very burned out in that career. And then I took a leap of faith and I went back to graduate school in San Francisco, got a degree in a master's degree in cultural anthropology. So that was another career I had for a while. Been a freelance writer and editor, nonprofit executive, most recently consultant and coach. And like I said, I'm just giving you the bare sampling of what I've done. So all of this was kind of like my way of trying to take a journey to figure out what is it that I love to do and what are the conditions I need to support that. So that's kind of what the book is based on, this long and winding journey I've had. And basically, in what I bring in the book, the process I bring, because what I started to realize after all these years of career and job hopping, it wasn't until about 10 years ago when it finally dawned on me, like, what would happen if I actually brought my practice into this process and used that as kind of a way to ground myself in some awareness. And that led to a whole different inquiry. And it wasn't so much anymore that I got frustrated and then I would leave and try a new thing. But I really used that process to look more deeply and to ask myself different kinds of questions than I had before. So that's essentially the book kind of shares with you that process that I went through and offers a framework for your own inquiry around work. But what I wanted to do a little bit tonight, since this is a Dharma talk, I wanted to just touch on some of the traditional teachings on right livelihood from the Buddha, and then take a look at how we might consider those in our contemporary times. How can we apply those to our life in a way that will help us realize right livelihood? God, I love hearing that rain. Yeah? Has it been pretty dry here? Well, what a blessing then, huh? So just to say a bit about traditional Dharma teachings about right livelihood. So as you might know, the Eightfold Path is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. And it's kind of a compass to help us align our lives in a way that will help liberate us from suffering. At least that's how I see it. And those eight paths are grouped into three areas. So there's a grouping of wisdom pathways, there's morality, and there's concentration. And right livelihood is found in the morality arm of the path, and it's in there along with right speech and right action. And I just want to say something about the word right, you know, that particular translation, right livelihood and all the other rights. To me, it's the right is not indicating like, oh, this is the only way to do it, the correct way. But there's actually another translation of the Pali word that can mean more integrated, whole. So it's a way that helps to bring us back into wholeness and into kind of a right relationship, a balanced relationship with whichever one of these pathways we're looking at. And also the paths don't stand alone. So right livelihood is meant to be fully integrated with right action, right speech, right view, and all the rest of the pathways. So in the Buddha's teachings, the most important aspect, at least as I understand it, when he was teaching and talking about right livelihood, is that it's a way to earn our living that does not cause harm. And that's kind of the essential ingredient here, is does not cause harm to others or to ourselves. In defining right livelihood, he named five types of businesses that lay people at that time should not engage in. And those were, first of all, dealing with weapons, trade of human beings, including slavery and prostitution, meat production and butchery, business in intoxicants, and business in poisons. And so it was actually rather simple. I mean, again, the focus was more on the negative aspect of it. So what are the things that right livelihood does not include? How can you make your living without causing harm to another or yourself? So when we look at the times that we currently live in, I think it gets a little bit more complicated than the Buddha's times for several reasons. One is that, and I'm talking particularly here in our Western culture, I think that our sense of individuation, you know, our personhood, is much more developed than it might have been in the Buddha's culture and time. For better or for worse, we have this sense of, you know, who we are as people, and we need to find meaning in that. And so our sense of work is very much an extension of that. Work becomes an expression of who we are. And our identity. It's very, very tied to our identity. And we've also inherited beliefs about work that have been shaped by capitalism and patriarchy. Beliefs that really, often without us realizing it, cause us to see people as disposable commodities. And that shapes our sense of who we are in our jobs as well. And our global economy is also very different than it was in the time of the Buddha. There certainly were some international, you know, cross transnational trade routes then, like the Silk Road, But a lot of what went on, a lot of the economies were very locally based. And that's really different than today's economy that's very interconnected in a very digital economy. Whereas now, even if you're in a livelihood that by itself does not cause harm, it is so interconnected with other pieces of the economy that it's hard to kind of separate anything out and say this is just a pure thing that doesn't cause harm. I think back to when I worked in the mental health system, and in some ways, that was a job where I got to do some good and help relieve some suffering for some folks. And yet on the other hand, it was, and it still is, it's a profession that so much relies on pharmaceuticals, and I can just remember, patients and clients getting Haldol and all the really toxic side effects from this. So, while on the one hand I was doing some good, on the other I was in a profession that was really complicit with this pharmaceutical industry that puts profits above people. So everything is tied to everything else. It's really hard to pull it apart these days. So as we look to write livelihood from that perspective, from now, the 21st century, as Westerners, I really think that in addition to not causing harm, which in itself is complex, but I feel like there is a sense of the nourishment piece that Baijiang talked about. So nourishment is really important. And having some kind of capacity to express our gifts through our work actually is important. I think we can't, just take ourselves completely out of it. So when you roll all that together, I think right livelihood, in addition to not causing harm, as the Buddha taught about it, it really is important to really consider, what kind of work will nourish me? What kind of work can I express my gifts through? How can I really do some good and find some meaning through my work? And I really love this quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. I think it kind of captures beautifully the way I think about this new version of right livelihood. This is a quote from the book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teachings. To practice right livelihood, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and for others. Our vocation can nourish our understanding and compassion, or erode them. We should be awake to the consequences, far and near, of how we earn our living. So when we take all that and put it in this context of present times, I find it helpful to think about, what gets in the way? What obstacles do we have to actually realizing right livelihood in our contemporary lives? And there's at least two of them. I'm sure there's many more. But two of them that come up really strongly for me as I went through this inquiry. The first one is that we believe the instructions that we've been given about work and related concepts like money. And this is where I kind of think like an anthropologist, because I feel like we get so much conditioning that we're often not so conscious of, and it can be really helpful to just slow down our process and just begin to identify the beliefs that we've inherited that may not necessarily be our own around what work means to us and what money means to us. And as part of doing that, I just want to offer you a little bit of an exploration right here. I'm going to invite you to close your eyes if you feel comfortable doing that. And I'm going to read some phrases to you. And I invite you to consider how these phrases might have played a part or even determined the way you relate to work in your life. Any choice that's related to work, and that might be from the kinds of jobs you feel like you can apply for, to how you act within those jobs, to how long you stay in them. So just listen to each one of these phrases and notice what happens as it lands in your body. Time is money. I need to work really hard until I retire so I have enough money in my retirement account. There's more security in working for someone else than in going out on my own. I have to mold myself to fit into the job description that's out there. Big gaps in my resume make it harder for me to get a job. Being an adult means sucking it up and working even when I hate my job. I would really love to create art or whatever your fill-in-the-blank might be, but I could never make money doing that. So if you want to open your eyes, and I'm curious, like, if anybody wants to share anything that came up as you heard those, or if there were other phrases that you started to realize, like, oh, that's part of how I see work in my life. Yes?
I realize that I have tended to call work the things that I've paid money for, even though there's lots of activities that I do that I love that are work. It's work. It's kind of like it's all work,
right,
in a way. But the things like, this isn't so much true now, as I'm sort of moving out of that part of my life, mm-hmm, but it's certainly for a long time, things that are super, super, that are really my main work of my life. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call my work when somebody would say, what's your work?
Right, right.
I would say the thing I get paid money for.
Yeah. That's so common, I think, that we couple work and money together. We're told that all the time. So I love that you're kind of expanding that for you, what that means, and realizing it's not always the same thing. Yeah. You're in the process.
In the process.
Yeah. I see another hand there. Yeah. Yeah. No kidding, huh? Any other reflections of those phrases did in you? Yes.
So I was going through all different ways I've earned a living. Like each of the phrases was like, oh, that was when I earned it that way. That was when I earned it that way.
Right.
I kind of was going through different things. Yeah. My two favorite words now in life, passive income.
Okay. We'll have to have you give a workshop on that.
That's what I'm talking about.
Great. And that was part of what, as I went through my kind of inquiry and as I brought more awareness practices to it, I started to really do that and just notice, like, well, wait a minute, like, is that true? I mean, I know I feel like it's true, but, you know, things like time is money, like, where is that coming from? And so I feel like the more we're able to kind of unpack those, we begin to have more choice and power over them. But I think where we so often get into trouble is where we just unconsciously kind of take this stuff on, right? And like I said, it has powerful implications for our life, not only around work, but just in general, like around our relationships and everything. And I really do think that this is like a whole other Dharma talk, but you know, I do believe capitalism shapes us in that way, that we often kind of override what's true in our bodies and our hearts, because we're kind of on this single track of how we're supposed to kind of move through our work world and our money world. So I think it's really an important empowerment practice to just go in there and use our practice to kind of see, is that true? What is that? Is that true? Yes?
I think a parallel. In my mind was a renunciation.
Renunciation?
Renunciation is, mm-hmm, is another whole, yeah, path of considering along with work. Mm-hmm. And how do I marry the two?
Exactly.
So if you say something like, well, I'd love to do art and music and beauty, but it won't feed me. Mm-hmm. From a renunciation point of view, it doesn't matter. Because you get that point where you feel like you're not going to be able to make it, pay the rent, get food. There's some kind of faith or some kind of something that goes along with care of themselves.
Mm, right. And community is part of that too, right? Oh, I mean, I think we're so shaped to think we have to do this all on our own, but how... And I think those of us who practice in sanghas, we get more practice in this, you know, how to learn about the practice of giving and receiving, that we're not all just doing this on our own. So there's so much that's tied to all of us.
That is exactly what it feels like. Yeah. If you're in community, if you need it, they'll take care of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot, as you can see, to just unfold from that one... that one obstacle. So I want to just tell you about the other thing that I found to be true and still find to be true. Another barrier on the way to realizing right livelihood is that we often believe our own press releases. And by that I mean that it can be really easy to get stuck in our identity around work. Remember before I talked about work is so intimately connected to our identity in our Western cultures. So, you know, we might have an identity as a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer. And that's not all a bad thing, right? And we take a lot of pride in that role that we play in our community, in the work that we do. We might go to conferences. We might write articles. So all those are not bad things per se. But what tends to happen is that the more we do it, the more we kind of like glommed it right onto our identity and that we can't imagine doing anything else. And if you love what you're doing, that's not a problem, right? But I think that's not always the case. And for some folks, they're like on this track and they've been in it for years and years. And this is kind of what happened to me, career number one. I was in the mental health profession for 10 years. And even though I was pretty miserable at the end, it was an incredible act of courage to think of even leaving that. Because I just felt like I had invested all this time in doing this. I was, you know, getting paid fairly well. I knew what I was doing. So to really kind of back off and say, but I'm not well. You know, I'm literally physically sick. So there's a way in which that's our press release. Like, this is who I am. This is how I get my, you know, identity in the world. And it comes through this professional role. It takes a lot of courage to look at that and say, that this isn't really working for me so well. And it can also separate us from others, too, when we over-identify with that role. So, I mean, one thing I've sometimes used as a mantra, I tend to be somebody who can do a lot of things really well. So that's one of the reasons I've had so many careers. It's like, okay, I'll do this now. But I think what I've begun to learn is that just because I can do something well doesn't mean I should be doing it. So some of you might relate to that. You know, you might find like people realize like, oh, well, she's a great organizer. And then you start getting all the organizing tasks. And, you know, and that can be fine for a while. And this is where it's got an interesting intersection with Dharma practice too, right? Because we get assigned to do things in the Zendo and like you just show up wholeheartedly and do them. So that's not bad, right? That's actually a really good practice. But I think it gets more complex when we take it out into the world and we're, again, like getting reinforced for things that maybe don't make us so happy or are not actually our true gifts to offer. So this is a whole other area where it's really, I think, really worthwhile taking time and energy to unpack that for ourselves. Like how much is our identity, you know, really making us happy or how much is it causing us suffering? So... and I also often think of this wonderful quote from Ram Dass. He often says, to identify with your soul, not your role. It's like so simple, but right to the point. It's like, it's not what you think it is necessarily. Just go deeper than that. So again, in my own kind of quest to figure all this out, what I started to learn through a lot of trial and error, I actually found for me what was true was that there were six, I call them six keys, but you could think of them as qualities or capacities, that really when I started practicing them all together, kind of like the Eightfold Path, the six keys, they were what started to make a difference in my own journey to find right livelihood and realize that for myself. So the six of them, and they're the heart of the book, actually, the six keys to liberation-based livelihood. And in the book, I spend quite a lot of time describing each one, just sharing stories about it, and offering you exercises and practices to strengthen them. So I want to just briefly tell you about them here. And you'll see when I tell you about them that, I mean, each one of them could be their own talk, and you could spend a lifetime really exploring them and practicing them. But just to give you a little taste of what they are. So key number one, the very first one, and there's a reason why they go in this order. So the first one has to happen first. The first one is become intimate with your core intention. And when I talk about a core intention, it's kind of like your why. It's not the same as a passion, you know, because I think passion gets used a lot in books about careers. And I have to tell you, when I was in my career search, like, I did all the stuff I was supposed to do. I read What Color Is Your Parachute? I went to a career counselor. I took aptitude tests. And those things were all good, but they were not hitting the level I needed to really work at this at. So for me, a core intention, I mean, my personal core intention is around helping to open people's hearts and minds through my writing and teaching. And it took me a long time to figure that out. But it's a why. So it's not that it's something that you necessarily love to do, your passion, but it's what you're here on the planet to offer. And I often think of my friend Alan Sanaki, who I'm sure some of you know, who's the vice abbot at Berkeley Zen Center. And I included this really, I love this quote from Alan that I put in the book here to try to describe what core intention is. So Alan says it this way: we are responsible for the world and to the world that we live in. A gift has been given to us to share with everyone. And to me, that's what I think a core intention is. So this becoming intimate with your core intention is really a process of practice, of, you know, there are questions you can ask yourself, you can be in conversation with other people. One of the exercises I have in the book, I call it mining for gold in your job history. So it's to really do a kind of thorough inventory of every job you've ever had, but not just paying jobs. You know, it could be volunteer work that you've done. It could be things like being a mom. So everything that you've had a responsibility in, to kind of go back and really look at that and see what in those positions or what in those responsibilities really lit you up, what wasn't so fun for you, and to kind of be a detective of your life, looking at your work, and to see what the clues are in your past. Because you'll find a lot of stuff. It's in there. So it's a matter, I think, of just offering yourself that gift of taking time to look at it and have some good questions to ask about it. The second key is valuing your gifts and your time. So once you've gotten more clear on what that core intention is, to me, and this is what I found in my process, there is a wonderful path of getting more protective of that. So remember what I said before about just because I'm good at something doesn't mean I should be doing it. As I got more clear on what my core intention was, I got to practice like saying no to things that fell outside of that. And you'll get a lot of requests coming at you. So there are a lot of opportunities to really say to yourself, like, that sounds great, but not for me. Like, I can't do that. And the time that people ask you for, you know, is that time something that you're actually investing in what it is that you really have to offer, or is it time that you're kind of throwing away? So I often think of that line from the Metta Sutta about a mother protecting her only child. So that's kind of what your core intention is. It's your child. And that fierce protection of it is how you actually begin to manifest it more in the world. The third key is breaking through inertia and taking action. So in my experience, as I got more clear on that core intention and began to protect it more, then you start to kind of realize, like, oh, this is what's being asked of me. It might be like, I need to leave this job that I'm in because it's really not working at all for me. Or maybe you get an inspiration that you want to actually start your own business or create art. Whatever it is, there will be something there, and it will require you to take action. And there are all kinds of reasons why we don't take action. So that key and the practices I have in there are all about how to kind of identify those places where we block ourselves and learn how to move ourselves into actually moving forward on what we need to actually do in our lives. The fourth key, and this kind of goes with the one that just came before it, is to make friends with uncertainty. Because what we'll find often is that as the action becomes clear, but we're holding ourselves back, it often is because of fear. And fear and uncertainty can go together. So we often don't make changes because we're really afraid of what could happen. And here I think is where practice really kicks in. To me, I feel like Zazen has been such a wonderful tool for learning how to be comfortable with discomfort, basically. So by taking our Zazen practice into our life in that way and moving through some of those blocks, we can actually take that energy of fear and turn it into something that's productive. The fifth key is to think big and make the most of your resources. And when I say that, thinking big, it doesn't mean that only huge projects that affect lots of people are, you know, okay. It's basically more about, and I think this may especially be true for women, I know it's certainly true for me, like there's a tendency to kind of like damp down what I can do, to make myself smaller than what I actually can offer. I tell a story in the book about, and here's, you know, another example of conditioning, but my mom grew up in the Great Depression, and her family was very much working class and had very little money. So when I was growing up, all the messages I got from my mom were basically what she prepared me for a livelihood was go be a secretary. Like, no matter what else you do, be a secretary because then you can fall back on that. You can always find a way to make money. And it was, I mean, it came from a good place. Like, she really cared about me. But it was really a way that I held myself back in so many ways. Like, I wouldn't go for things I really loved to do because I had that message, like, you know, you can't make money doing it, and you're not going to survive if you try to do that. So when I talk about thinking big, I'm just talking about how to break out of our box of smallness. You know, you can do actually really beautiful things that are not huge, but to do them in a way where you're honoring your vision and your gift. And then the other half of that is making the most of your resources. And often when we think of resources, our mind goes towards money. Like, well, I can't do that because I don't have enough money. And I really encourage people in the book and through exercises to start identifying all the kinds of resources you have. There's community, right? There's time. There's the gifts that you have. So money is only one of many kinds of resources. And when we look at it that way, we can really see that we're rich, even if we don't have a lot of money. And then finally, the sixth key is build a circle of allies and ask for help. So this kind of is moving towards that community, that Sangha piece. And just realizing that the people that we surround ourselves with really impact how we're able to live out our dreams. So if we're around folks who are very fear-based, and if we haven't quite learned how to establish ourselves outside of our own fear, that's going to really keep us in that place of smallness. And then asking for help, you know, as we build that circle of allies of people who are holding our biggest vision along with us, to really consider, you know, what is it that we need that will help us move towards right livelihood for us? And to practice asking for that. I know as I've been on this book tour, and it hasn't been for that long, I mean, talking with you all, I think it's the third thing that I've done on the book tour. But it's been a really wonderful experience of just showing up and sharing what I've done and asking people to help support it in whatever way they can, whether that's buying the book or telling other people about it. But it's really an edge for me to just put myself out there and say, here's what would help. So these six keys, and as you can probably begin to see, it's like they're not just about work. If you can actually practice these keys in your life, you will have, I feel like I'm talking like a prophet now, but you know, they really will help your life to become more whole and more joyous. So that's kind of the hidden secret behind these six keys. They're not just for work. But they certainly have been, in my experience, what have helped me to move myself to a place where I have work that I love. And as I talk about in the book, you know, a lot of this, I think, is like what you were talking about. It's redefining what work means to us. So it's not always a 9-to-5 job. There are many forms it can take. And I think we're living in a time when there's a lot of creative forms of work. So this is a time to really take advantage of that. So just going back again to the Buddha's original teachings about livelihood. You know, again, that instruction, the essential instruction is to don't cause harm. You know, to look at where we're at right now in relationship to our work. Where is there suffering? And how might these six keys help you to kind of work your way through that suffering and free yourself from it? And in the process, I mean, if you think about all the people that we're connected to, you know, I think back to my dad and how that impacted my life to watch him come home suffering every night. You know, our work is not just about us. It really impacts our family, our friends, our community. So when we're able to realize right livelihood, what I call liberation-based livelihood, we become a source of joy, not just for ourselves, but for everybody in our circle and everybody in our extended circle. So I wanted to end. There's this wonderful poem called To Be of Use by Marge Piercy. Some of you probably know it. So these are just beautiful words, I think, to end this idea of right livelihood, liberation-based livelihood. The people I love the best jump into work head first, without dallying in the shallows, and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest, and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm, when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands and crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing, well done, has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put in museums, but you know that they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real. So, thank you so much for sitting and listening, and thank you for your work in the world, whatever that might be.
Are inexhaustible. I vow to transcend. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.